serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a tribute this week to the one and only Jack Schwartz, who passed away November 7th at the age of 103. He was as sharp as ever, right up to the end, all those decades-old memories still crystal clear, like all four of the Japanese prison camps he spent time in during World War II, and the day he found out Japan had surrendered.
We were up to the camp, and the Japanese officers in charge of the camp came in and said, here again. Hostilities have ceased, and he and the guards just walked off and left us. There was no place we could go.
So you prisoners were all alone up there, no guards, no Japanese?
That's correct, but where are you going to go? So we painted a big POW on the roof of the barracks, and it wasn't until, I'm pretty sure it was at least 2 weeks before we saw a B-29 fly way, way above us, and 2 hours later, and parachutes were dropping out of the camp full of food. Boy, we all got crazy, throwing up all over the place, eating too much. But why not? Finally, a group of Army people came up, including nurses. And this is amusing, too. The first thing they did was spray us with DDT.
To kill all the lice?
Lice and fleas, stuff, bed bugs. We had them all. And, of course, they wouldn't do it now, but it did get rid of them anyway. And then there was, I didn't mark the date. I used to keep a diary, but I've lost it. But there was sometime about September the 8th when they finally came up with trucks and took us down to the railroads, and we took the railroad to Yokohama. There they separated out the Army and the Navy, and they put the Navy people on board the U.S. Iowa, which was there, and just stayed there overnight. And we were still in rags, and they gave us uniforms. They wore Kappa uniforms then. And the next day they flew us out. So we get on the planes to fly out. The last thing I did before I got out was spit on the ground. And we flew for about a half an hour over Tokyo. All you could see was completely burned out. And then we came back and landed because one of the motors was no good.
Boy, you talk about a letdown after 4 years as a prisoner and your plane ride home has to go back to where you started.
Exactly. Anyhow, we took off again and flew back to Guam. What a difference, because instead of a little shabby island, there were airfields there, all kinds of things. And this is another funny one. They took us to the Naval Hospital. You'll never guess who was in charge. It was one of the Navy nurses who was captured with us, because the Navy nurses were sent home with the ambassador in May of 42. And here she was back on Guam again as the chief nurse. Of course, it was nice knowing somebody. And we stayed there for about a week and sort of got used to living again. We got all uniforms. They gave us each $100, as I recall it. And finally, we all got orders and shipped home. But we went home on a naval vessel. Here again, they didn't have room, but they built shells. We were sleeping three deep on shells. But this didn't matter because we were eating like pigs. And it took us 17 days to get home. And we stopped in Hawaii. Here's another funny one. The captain of the ship wouldn't let us off. He said, I will not be responsible for prisoners of war that I'm taking back to San Francisco. One of the guys on the ship was a Navy ensign, a flyer, and his father, he knew, was an admiral around Honolulu. He called him, and an hour later, we off the ship. But then we got to San Francisco.
And the captain wasn't trying to be malicious. He just didn't want to be responsible for one of you not making a home, right?
Well, that's exactly. I'm sure he thought he had to do it. I'm sure he wasn't being mean to us, but it was really. And it keeps getting funny, ha-ha. We got to San Francisco and land at Fort Mason and get off the ship. Oh, incidentally, while I was on Guam, I called my wife. I called her from Honolulu, so she was up there to meet me. What's between us and the families? A six-foot-high wooden fence. So here we are back in San Francisco. We're still prisoners. And we called each other over the fence. She told me where she was at a hotel. And then they took all of us to Oakville Naval Hospital. And we checked in there. I stayed there an hour, walked out, and thumbed a ride back to San Francisco and took a train home. Took a train home when I was home. Of course, everybody was happy to see me. But I knew I had to do something, so I went down to the Long Beach Naval Hospital, checked in there. I was reported as being AWOL. There was nobody bothered about. So that was the end of my captivity.
What was it like for you, aside from talking to her over that wooden fence, when you actually got to look in your wife's eyes again and see her? Because I imagine there had to be a lot of those 1,367 days that you thought about that moment and envisioned that happening someday.
Well, we did, but I can't recall actually what we thought. Actually, I was happy I was, obviously, but I can't recall any details. We did take the train in L.A., and I was still out of uniform. I mean, practically, partly uniform. I was wearing a sweater. We had notes in our pockets to the shore patrol not to pick us up in case they did. That was about it. I stayed in Los Angeles on leave. They gave us accumulated leave and 60 days sick leave. So it wasn't until April of 46 that I actually got back on the duty. In the meantime, I was still Lieutenant J.G., and it turned out during the war it was practically automatic promotions as the war went on, but they couldn't promote you unless you were there to sign the papers, so we didn't sign them. So about every 6 weeks I got promoted first to lieutenant, lieutenant commander, then to commander, so that's why I ended up at. But
how long did you stay in the Navy?
I stayed in until 1962. I had some fantastic duties.
And I can tell you enjoyed all the duty you had, but I'm sure there's some people saying, hey, if I went in the military, ended up spending 4 years of my life as a prisoner with nothing to eat and nothing to wear and not that many people to talk to, the first thing I'd want to do is get out of the military. But you stayed in for another 17 years after World War II. What was it that you think made you do that and made you love your country and love the Navy as much as you did?
Well, as I say, when I first joined up and got my commission, I knew then a war was going to start. It would be stupid not to know it in 1940. That's why I got in. After I got out, I said, gee, I've seen the worst. Let's see what it's like. See what's good. I'd seen the bad. Yeah. And I did stay in. And as I say, I had wonderful duties, so I'm glad I did stay in. They sent me down to Key West, Florida. That was paradise. And I met my future wife down there and got married. My son was born down there. My stepdaughter, who lives here, was my wife's first child. Of course, she's still mine. I would say that duty in Key West was probably the happiest time of my life, really. Everything was wonderful there.
And then in 1962, you moved here to Hanford, and you've served as this city's director of public works. You've been the city engineer. You're still serving on the grand jury. You must like it here in Hanford a little bit.
Well, let's back up. I want to tell you about the rest of my career.
Oh, go ahead.
From Key West, I got another great duty. They sent me to just outside of Paris. I was on the staff of the, it was called UCOM, the European Command, the headquarters of all the Americans in Europe. It was called Camp Deluge. It wasn't in Paris. It was about 20 miles outside. Boy, what a break being in there for a little over 3 years. I really enjoyed that duty, too. We traveled a lot, saw all we could of Europe, at least on the western part of it. I did not make captain, so I was due to retire at 20 years, but by some quirk, I was extended for 26 years. I didn't want to retire before I left Europe because that was such good duty. So they sent me back to another good duty, which is at Flagstaff, Arizona. Down there, they were in charge of the nuclear testing up at Mercury, Nevada, and I got put in charge of a project up there. It was the first project where a nuclear weapon was discharged under granite. They were doing some testing to see what they were doing before they built the headquarters there in the Rockies. And that was one of the tests to see what how things reacted in granite. After that was done, I retired and came to Hanford.
On that project, I'm curious, and I'm sure a lot of people are, what was it that you had to do, and was there some responsibility there for you that people's safety was going to depend on the work that you did to design how this was going to work?
Actually, I had nothing but design. It was designed many years before. But there was a tunnel. We went down 900 feet and then spread out a few hundred feet and made sort of circular tunnels and put different kinds of lining materials in. Wood, steel, soft things like styrofoam, all kinds of different linings. And when they set this nuclear device off, we went back and saw which ones were affected and how they were affected. That was the reason for the project.
So I'm sure I'm not the only one hearing you say that and saying, so they set off a nuclear device in there, and then you went back in, and people are saying, well, what about the radioactivity? So were you in these super spaceman plastic protective suits to keep the radiation out?
Absolutely not. The radiation didn't go that far. The force did, but not the radiation. In fact, they compared the radiation effect there to what's on your wristwatch. So it was really zero, as close to zero as they could get. So it was perfectly safe. While I was there, I knew I was going to retire. It took 6 months to retire, and I saw this. I was looking for a job, and I was already a registered civil engineer in California. I did that while I was still working in California before the Civil War. I saw this job in Hanford, applied for it, got it, and was very happy with it, so I stayed here. It's sort of funny, I've been here over 50 years, and in my first 49 years, I traveled so much, it was such a difference. Hanford's a great place.
Hanford is a great place, and I know Hanford is happy to have you and is proud of you and should be. A couple more questions, and feel free to add anything that comes to your mind. And I have to ask this question of every veteran I interview, and especially the POWs, like your story, which is an amazing story. And I haven't gotten the sense that you're an overly sentimental guy or a really extremely emotional guy or anything like that. But I still have to ask the question. When you think about everything that you went through, everything that you survived, knowing how many others died in captivity, 30% of all prisoners held by the Japanese died, and then you think about the career that you just told us how much you enjoyed in the Navy and the fact that you got to be a father and a grandfather and do all the things you've done, that none of that would have happened had you died in captivity. How do you account for that? Do you feel like somebody was looking out for you? Is it just the way it happened? How do you think about that reality, that you survived all of that?
I just think I was lucky, that's all. I'm not an agnostic. I'm sure there's a God. I don't believe there's a personal God. If there is one, he took care of me, I guess.
I guess the only other question I would have for you is, what are you most proud of and what are you most thankful for?
I'm proud of the way I did my work in Hanford. I think it did a lot of good because it was pretty disorganized when I got here. And I organized it quite well, I think, and lived it in good shape. So I'm proud of that.
Jack Schwartz had so much to be proud of, and they'll always be proud of his legacy in Hanford, California, where he spent the last 56 of his 103 years. Before we finish today, let's hear more from his son, Jack Jr., who 3 years ago had the opportunity to accompany his then 99-year-old dad on a cathartic journey back to Japan.
I cannot fathom. It's beyond my comprehension to try and figure out and imagine that I could have gone through what he did, much less what a lot of the other POWs in Bataan and Corregidor went through. I can't fathom it.
And that trip to Japan with him, he's 99 years old, and the two of you with some other POWs are seeing things that he probably never thought he would see. What were some of the things you experienced on that trip that made an impact?
The first major impact was coming in from the airport, because when my dad and all the other POWs had left, Tokyo and Yokohama had been devastated by the carpet bombing and the firebombing. And to a man, they were just shocked and amazed at how big and how robust Tokyo is. They had us going to the foreign ministry, and we had a really nice meeting with the deputy foreign minister and some legislators. We had a press conference, and we met with a group that does POW research and an NGO, and with students from Temple University. But one of the highlights of the trip was meeting Ambassador Carolyn Kennedy. She was so gracious. She spent a good 15 to 20 minutes with each POW, just talking. It was a highlight of the trip. But one of the parts of the trip was we broke up into groups and went to different parts of Japan. And so the group that my dad was in was with two other POWs, and we went to Yokohama. The Kawasaki 2B camp that my dad had been in, but was transferred back to Zensuchi before July of 45, was carpet bombed. And we went to the area where the Amari camp is, where Bill Sanchez was, and Louis Zamperini, and many others. Right after that, we went to an industrial plant, and a lot of the industrial plants there have rooms set aside with the history of the war and whatnot. And we went to a plant, and my dad goes, "Why are we at this plant? My guys, they went to a different plant." And a woman from the NGO goes, "Well, we're going to go to your camp next." He goes, "Why? There's nothing left." He goes, "Oh, no, there's a building left." My dad goes, "Really? Well, let's go. So we went to it. I've got pictures of my dad sitting in front of this building during World War II. And sure enough, this one building is still there. That was a high point, obviously, of the trip. But when I got back to the hotel, I went to the Manziel website and pulled up a picture. And sure enough, there's that one building. Everything is devastated. But that one building is standing up there. So that's pretty neat. So Dad really appreciated that and enjoyed that. No, I'd say all of the POWs and my dad were just amazed at Japan. At some point, one of the reporters or somebody asked him, well, what do you think of the food in Japan? And my dad's comment was, best damn food I've ever had in Japan. And after reading his diary, that adds more emphasis to it. But then we also went down to Hiroshima. That was really memorable. Went to the museum and the Peace Park and saw the one building that's still standing with the frame. It was really an amazing trip, not only from seeing what the transformation, but listening to all of the stories of the POWs, seeing my dad's reaction to things. It was an amazing trip.
Well, I got a crazy question for you, because I know your dad was way ahead of schedule on so many things. You know, the youngest kid graduating from high school, youngest guy at Caltech, youngest engineer, all these youngest. Yet he lives to 103 with a full head of hair, a full beard, and a sharp mind. Do you think that what he had to go through for close to 4 years as a POW helped extend his longevity or made him so resilient that that had a hand in him living so long and so well?
I think that may have had a part to it. His side of the family has longevity, except for his father. His father passed away when he was 46 of a heart attack. But I think that the endurance that they had to summon for themselves during their times of prisoner war, I think really did have an impact on my dad afterwards. Obviously, besides physically, he had physical problems, but mentally, he kept himself busy during the camp. He learned Japanese, he taught calculus, and he always kept his mind going until the very end. And I think that it is quite possible that his experiences put him in a frame of mind that he didn't sweat the little things. Yeah, he was very even keeled. He survived cancer. He survived a heart attack when he was 89 with quadruple bypass surgery. He was a survivor. And a lot of it, I think, was mental. He just kept going through it and just persevered.
Maybe that answers my last question. Anything else you want to say about your dad, feel free. But I don't think I'd be doing my job if I didn't ask you what the most important things you learned from your dad.
They broke the mold when he was born. I mean, I look at what he was able to accomplish and the love that he had for my mother and her daughter, Joan, and for me. I think it establishes a baseline for life to try and strive to. And I try and strive for it, and I don't succeed a lot of times, just in comparison to what my dad went through and what he accomplished. But my younger son calls him a beast. And, you know, he was. He respected people, and people respected him. And he was just, I mean, he was writing, he was playing Scrabble, he was just active until the very end. And for that, I'm very thankful.
When you live to be 103 and you live the way Jack Schwartz did, you compile a pretty extensive list of lives that were touched, perspectives that were altered, people who were inspired. And in Jack's case, people who are going to treasure his hand-turned wooden bowls. I'm proud to count myself in that number and thankful for this resilient ex-prisoner of war who, even after his passing, has reminded us again today that freedom is not free.